This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 8th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 438. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, highlights of a House of Commons committees on the China file. Hear from former diplomat Michael Kovrig, new Foreign Influence Registry Commissioner Anton Bogman, and the latest in the BC Ferries China scandal. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. In January, Prime Minister Mark Carney went to Beijing to meet Xi Jinping and declared China to be Canada's new strategic partner. Since then, the fourth anniversary of Russia's invasion of Canadian ally Ukraine, NATO calls China the decisive enabler of Russia. At the end of February, the U.S. and Israel bombed Tehran, killing Iran's Ayatollah Khamenei, an ally of both Russia and China. Persian people celebrated around the world. That means this is a good time to find out what our federal lawmakers are doing on the China file. February 26th, the Committee on International Trade heard from Michael Kovrig, the former diplomat who was held hostage from 2018 to 2021 by China in retaliation for the arrest of Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou in Vancouver on U.S. fraud charges. Liberal Peter Fonseca.
So how should Canada operationalize this strategic realism that we are in, and how to do it tactically?
Right. So the framework I would start with, right, is that for the Chinese Communist Party, economic outcomes are geopolitical outcomes on a path to revise the international power hierarchy and to gain political and strategic advantages over Canada. So where individual firms are obviously looking to profit maximize and seek opportunities, the role the government needs to play and civil society needs to play is to really impose a net benefit test on any kind of significant investment or new trade deal, right? It requires calculating asymmetric costs and benefits, because the benefits are going to be concentrated in a few companies, communities, and shareholders. But if to manage those benefits, Canada then has to spend more on national defense, on the security agencies, on preventing foreign espionage and influence, that's diffused across all taxpayers. And so that, I think, needs to be, first of all, part of the calculation. Secondly, obviously, there are a number of different mechanisms to assess it. I'm not suggesting that there should be total decoupling or no trade with China. Trade with China can continue in non-sensitive sectors that don't touch on, for example, military technology, dual use technologies, national security, and other things. And the improvements over the last several years in the investment screening processes, for example, that ICED has, are a critical part of that. But I think Canada needs to make sure that it has adequate outbound investment screening as well as inbound investment screening. And the other key litmus test is not so much whether or not there is trade, but the proportion of trade at the sectoral level, right? The top line number is, of course, not that large. Canada is not that dependent on trade or investment with China. It's the second largest, but it's only around 4%. What matters is that there are certain sectors that are particularly dependent. And as we've seen multiple times now, the Chinese Communist Party will weaponize that interdependence for coercive purposes to change Canadian policy. Canada then loses sovereignty and political decision-making and autonomy. So what you need to, I think, is to establish what would be a ceiling for a particular sector, let's say canola or pork or seafood. What's the most that we are willing to sell to one buyer, particularly a large buyer with hostile foreign policies? And then how do we manage to offset that by seeking other trade partners? So the role of the government there, for example, would then be to look at that given sector and incentivize more balancing trade with other more trusted partners, so that if the Chinese Communist Party chooses to use that and close its market, Canada can shrug it off and survive and move on. And that way we can maximize the potential economic benefits of trade with the national security and sovereignty concerns that we have.
Conservative Jason Grillo.
Mr. Kovrig, it's an honor to speak with you today. I would like to pay tribute to your great resilience for having spent so much time as a detainee in China in wake of political reprisal. In terms of international security, foreign affairs, well, simple. Is Canada a reliable, China rather, a reliable partner for Canada or not?
Merci beaucoup pour la question.
Thank you very much for your question.
To thank all of you for your very kind statements about me. The support of Parliament and of all Canadians was immensely helpful to me in going through that ordeal, so I'm deeply grateful. The short answer to your question is no. The Chinese Communist Party is manifestly not a reliable partner for the fundamental reason that systemically, it's not about the individuals involved. Systemically, it does not have checks and balances, or transparency or democratic accountability. And its attitude toward the rule of law and its worldview are fundamentally different from that of any country with a Westminster-style parliament or, you know, whether common law or civil law. The law in China and in the eyes of the Communist Party is simply another political tool, an instrument of power. And so international treaties and accords and, for example, consular agreements are just paper that are only adhered to if it is seen as being within the political interests of the Communist Party to adhere to them. So if it is not a system that fundamentally respects contracts. And in my, I can use the example of my own case, where in detaining me, China violated the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, the Canada-China Consular Agreement, and also a number of human rights covenants to which it is a signatory. And that's just one small example. It is a regime that routinely violates accords. Another example, of course, is in the South China Sea, where it ignored the ruling of the International Tribunal in a dispute with the Philippines and has proceeded to do so. So it will follow laws and rules when it is convenient for it to do so. But as we've seen, particularly with its role in the World Trade Organization, it often creates the useful semblance of being a guardian and supporter of globalization and a rules-based order while actively undermining and exploiting it from within. And that creates critical problems for it as a potential trading or otherwise partner for Canada.
Merci, Monsieur Covert. Êtes-vous préoccupé par l'arrivée?
Thank you. Are you concerned by the arrival of EVs in terms of hampering Canadian industry? Are there potential risks with respect to security in your view?
Yes, I think I would not be the only one to assess that electric vehicles pose a risk in the same way that if we don't allow Huawei to build our 5 or 6G telecommunications backbone, why would we allow BYD to sell cars into the Canadian market? They can gather up enormous amounts of information, both on their drivers and on everyone around them. And there's ample documentation of this. Now, the key question there is whether or not Canada has the technical capabilities to mitigate those risks, for example, through cybersecurity safeguards, binding local production requirements, snapback mechanisms that would allow Canada to change a quota or close a quota if it turns out that things are not going the way we want. I think that is one crucial thing that the government's automotive initiatives and strategies seem to be incorporating, and it needs to incorporate, is that, you know, to treat this as an experiment with the capability of pulling it back and stopping it if it turns out it's going in a dangerous direction. But there are unquestionably cybersecurity risks. The issue is whether they can be mitigated, but also from an economics and trade standpoint and an investment standpoint, is it worth going to the trouble of having to do all those mitigations? Does the benefit actually outweigh the cost to the taxpayer of all those additional cybersecurity provisions? And one of my core arguments about trade with China is not that individual companies can't make some money by trading or that individual investments might not be worthwhile, but that the cost of security and mitigation measures that Canada as a whole will have to take on in order to make those investments safe, both from a cybersecurity perspective and from a political influence perspective, may end up outweighing the value of those investments in that trade.
Simon Pierre Savard Tremblay of the Bloc Québécois.
I recently learned that there was an agreement with Taiwan, but we're just waiting for it to be signed, and this is on the PM's desk. we can't assume this, but that we think it will not please China. Do we think an agreement with Taiwan would be something we would want?
Yes, I think it's actually quite important, in fact, to continue to move forward with agreements with Taiwan, and we should be actively deepening Canada's support for and engagement with Taiwan and maintain a polite diplomatic stance with China that doing so, as long as those things are within the parameters of Canadian foreign policy guidelines on the One China policy, there is no reason why Canada should not be able to do those things. And indeed, Canada should also be encouraging like-minded democracies and allies to be strengthening ties with Taiwan. It should, you know, we should not accept a false dichotomy that Beijing would want to force on Canada, that we must choose between relations between China and Taiwan when we are talking about commercial agreements on trade and investment, for example.
The Hogue Commission report in 2025 confirmed that China interfered in Canada's 2019 and 2021 federal elections. February 26th, at the Procedure and House Affairs Committee, a hearing to nominate Anton Bogman as the first Foreign Influence Transparency Commissioner. Bogman's previous job was in Victoria as the Chief of Elections British Columbia, which came under scrutiny after the 2024 provincial election. Here is Langley Aldergrove Conservative Taco Van Popta.
Focus on the riding called Surrey-Guildford, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. That was a riding where the NDP incumbent won by a narrow margin of 22 votes, and so obviously those 22 votes are very important to the people in that riding, and this supports our argument, our pep talk with our volunteers that every vote counts. But in this case, it was really particular because it actually had an influence at the provincial level, because if that vote had gone the other way, Mr. Eby would have been denied his one vote majority. My facts are right, correct?
Yes.
So far, good.
Correct.
Thank you. Now, you'll also be aware that the unsuccessful candidate, the Conservative candidate, Mr. Randhawa, commenced legal action to overturn the certification of the vote, arguing that there were some voting irregularities at a senior's home, which coincidentally had 22 mail-in ballots. And all those... The request for those mail-in ballots came from one ISP, a computer that was tied to the administrative office of that facility. So it was somebody doing this in a coordinated fashion. Now, you state in the court documents, paragraph 98, receiving multiple requests for mail-in packages from a single computer session or location does not on its own signal to Elections BC that there has been any wrongdoing or contravention of the Elections Act. I would agree with that assessment. But then you go on to say the vote-by-mail team decided to fulfill the request from the facility to ensure the voters received their mail-in packages in time. In the next sentence I would underline. However, the team failed to follow up with the district electoral officer, Ms. Dolly, right, for that riding, to confirm that the individual at the facility was appointed as an election official. So somebody dropped the ball. And now I take being appointed as election official would require some basic training, like perhaps how to help patients under their care to vote without influencing their vote. And that seems not to have happened. So can the voters of Surrey-Guildford rest assured that those 22 mail-in ballots did not influence the outcome of the vote in that riding, and that the vote as you certified it is the true expression of the majority of that riding?
Thank you for the question. There may be some parts to that I'm very happy to respond to. Others are in the hands of Elections BC. I'm no longer, of course, the chief electoral officer there. The lawsuit was filed. The lawsuit was dropped by the candidate in Surrey-Guildford. That happened after my term ended, so I have no information in relation to why that happened, what was behind that. I do know that the plan, at least when I was chief electoral officer, was if the proceedings would take place in court, then the courts would determine validly what happened and what didn't happen. If they would not, then it would be an investigation for Elections BC to do. And so I can't
challenge
speak to Elections
you, BC. I'm challenge you just a bit on that, because you do say in your in the same document that that Mr. Randhawa was just out of time. He missed the limitation period. So Elections BC was basically saved by the bell. He had to drop the case, move on, live to fight another day. But my concern is that it's particularly such a tight race, whether Elections BC actually exercised the due diligence that you would have expected as a professional, that your team lived up to the demands of the day.
So the requirement to appoint an individual as an election official is something that is done, but it's not required under the legislation. It's not absolutely necessary under the legislation.
But in this case, it might have been appropriate. I've also read the affidavit of the Green candidate who said that he had tried to canvass him and was told, no, these people are all sick. They don't vote. Yet 22 people did cast a vote. Raises some suspicion anyways. I would have expected perhaps some alarm bells would have started going in your office.
So I can say that based on the information that I was provided as chief electoral officer, I believe that the election was administered in accordance with the legislation. I do not believe that, that activities counter to that took place.
Fair enough. It'll never be tested in court, of course. One follow-up question. How were the lessons
is it a very
from,
and
from, how are the elections?
Mr. Van Popta, you don't get to self-rule on your. Go ahead. We have a little bit of time. You can go ahead, but brief
question.
Leave
you up with a friendly question. How are the lessons of Elections 43 going to help you be a better foreign influence transparency commissioner for all of Canada?
So there's always lessons to be learned in various roles and from different people that I associate with. So I think for me, what was reinforced is that training can always be better. Training of the staff who are performing roles can always be better, even though you put what you think is decent training in. Whenever there are people who are interacting at these roles, human nature and complexity of legislation can mean that inadvertent errors are possible to take place. So you can always...
Finally, on February 25th, the Transport, Infrastructure and Communities Committee continued its investigation of the $1 billion federal loan to BC Ferries. That loan triggered the contract to buy 4 new ferries from Chinese state-owned shipyard CMI Weihai. BC Ferries has refused to release the contract to the Breaker.News, which is appealing to BC's Information and Privacy Commissioner. Here is Okanagan Lake West South Kelowna Conservative Dan Albus.
What specific national security assessment has public safety conducted to rule out embedded surveillance hardware or software in these ferries being built in China?
Public Safety Minister Gary Ananasangari.
There was no security assessment. This was outside of the scope of the work that our national security apparatus do. This was a procurement that was undertaken by BC Ferries in the province of British Columbia, and it is very much outside the scope of the work that we undertake.
Well, Minister, I got to say, the fact that no security review has been done is unfathomable to me. Transport Canada states plainly that Canada does not have comprehensive legislation to manage the risks identified on this file, and that existing oversight focuses only on performance and safety rather than mitigation of national security concerns. Example given, unauthorized data access or surveillance. Why would public safety permit foreign-built ferries to be imported before the government closes this legislative gap? What do you have to say, sir?
Mr. Albus, I don't want to demean your understanding of Canadian federalism, but let me take this moment to say that we are the federal government. This particular procurement was undertaken by the province, as you're aware, province of British Columbia. They have every authority to do that. They have their own laws and guidelines that they follow. And it is very much in that vein that this particular procurement was undertaken. So it does...
Security review by Public Safety Canada. Transport Canada says that we have legislative gaps that do not cover this kind of stuff. Minister, Transport Canada also warns that vessels built in China will have access to Canadian waterways and could gather information related to critical underwater infrastructure, as well as critical North American supply routes. Minister, what is public safety's threat assessment regarding foreign-built ferries mapping, scanning, or otherwise collecting intelligence on underwater cables or other important data infrastructure?
What I can say is that every vehicle, every vessel that comes here will have to meet Canadian standards.
You've said there's no review, sir.
Well, there are two different things, right?
One is a review, one is the safeguards
that are in place. And in this particular case, the BC government procured these vessels.
So the BC government has the right to put our national security and the Canadians' own national security at risk. Is that what you're saying, sir?
What I'm saying is that they have the prerogative to undertake.
They have the prerogative.
They have the prerogative to undertake procurement according to their laws, according to their rules. And in this case, that is exactly what has happened. But what I can say is that vehicles, whether it be EV vehicles or those vessels that are being procured, still need to be in line with Canadian standards.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, court gives mostly suspended sentences in recall forgery case. Workers at the Kuomintang's Taichung chapter falsified documents in an effort to recall two lawmakers from the Democratic Progressive Party last year. The court said it sentenced the chapter's senior officials, Chen Chengfeng and Wu Kanglong, to 21 months and 23 months in prison, respectively, suspended for 5 years. Both Wu and Chen were also stripped of their civil rights for 2 years and ordered to pay fines of about $10,000 U.S. to the public treasury. In ABC News Australia, coroner finds Piper James died on Kigari from drowning due to dingo attack. The Queensland coroner said the young Vancouver Island woman drowned after sustaining multiple injuries due to or as a consequence of a dingo attack. In Kyoto news, Washington's cherry blossoms to peak in late March after Japan Prime Minister's visit. Sanae Takeuchi's visit to the U.S. Capitol later this month for a meeting with President Donald Trump. This year's national festival, commemorating the 1912 gift of about 3,000 cherry trees from Tokyo to Washington as a symbol of friendship, will run from March 20th to April 12th. Japan has committed to donating 250 cherry trees to the United States for its 250th anniversary of independence. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, new data shows Oregon e-scooter injuries on the rise. The number of e-scooter injuries reported by Oregon hospitals and emergency departments has more than doubled in 5 years. From 2021 to 2024, annual injury reports jumped from 211 to 418, and in just the first 9 months of 2025, there had been 509 such reports. In the Seattle Times, fireball seen in Western Washington, B.C. Dozens of people across Western Washington and B.C. reported a bright streak across the sky a little after 9 p.m. on March 3rd. Most called it a fireball. And a fireball it was, said Robert Lunsford, field report coordinator for the American Meteor Society, where people can log meteor sightings online. 18 people reported this one. The meteor was likely a rock a few inches in diameter that blasted into the Earth's atmosphere at over 200,000 miles per hour. That's fast. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. What does ChatGPT know about Jesse Van Rensselaer? I tried to find out. And cutbacks at Vancouver's FIFA Fan Festival? Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to social workers across British Columbia, the people who help foster children to senior citizens to the homeless. It is Social Work Week in BC from March 8th to 14th. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar? Send me an email to Bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 8th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 8th of March in 2014, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 and its 239 passengers went missing between Kuala Lumpur and Beijing? The search continues to this day. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.